Well, thanks for joining us, Jonathan Wilson. I have to add, right off the top, do you go by Jonathan, John, Wilson? I've heard you called so many different things. I don't know what you'd like me to call you or refer to you as.
Just go with Jonathan. Yeah, right. It's just a bit of the Guardian. Like, everybody's called Jonathan, so we tend to be referred to as by surnames to differentiate us.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, thanks for joining the Kick Around. I don't know if you have any. I mean, how aware are you of the popularity of Inverting the Pyramid as a book for people, especially here in the States, where there's so many people that are new to the game and learning about the game?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen the sales figures, which are great, and I've seen the checks I get as a result of that, which are even better. And yeah, I have to say, I was slightly surprised that it made the appearances in Ted Lasso. But I guess that's very flattering. And I think, you know, even the final episode of the second season was the title of that episode was something to do with inverting the pyramid. So I guess that means it has a traction and recognizability.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was going to get into that later on in a later question, but I'll just start there. So you had no awareness that your book was going to make kind of Easter egg appearances in Ted Lasso. You had no forewarning about that?
No, not a clue. No.
And you haven't received any benefit? Like, they didn't pay you for the appearance other than the residual book sales, I suppose.
I mean, I'm pretty sure there have been residual book sales, but no, there's been absolutely no contact between me and them.
Okay, so I have to know. So what is that existence? What is that experience like for you? Are you just sitting at home one day and somebody goes, "Hey, mate, your book's on this new TV show I'm watching about an American soccer coach"?
Pretty much, yeah. Suddenly got a load of messages on Twitter. People I don't even know saying, "Oh, look, your book's on this new show," and it's okay. That's nice.
Well, that has to kind of change your perspective of what the book means then, because so for writers to throw your book in to kind of passively suggest it's some sort of Bible or journal about soccer tactics or football tactics, does that change your feelings about what you produced as a piece of content?
I suppose it does. I mean, I hadn't really given it that much thought, but yeah, I mean, it's obviously very flattering that it has that sort of, that it has that instant recognizability, that people, know what that symbolizes.
All right. Well, look, as an American who's loved the game and followed the game, dating back into the 80s and 90s, I found Inverting the Pyramid to be infinitely helpful in terms of just understanding the game better. So I kind of wanted to ask you about your history with the sport and how you ended up becoming a journalist and then deciding you needed to write a book about tactics. That's a lot. Sorry, Jonathan.
Football's been there forever. I don't remember a time when football wasn't a key part of my life. So yeah, very earliest memories. Yeah. 20-5 on a Saturday, you had to be by the telly or by a radio to get the scores. I was in the days when games finished at 20-5 rather than 5 o'clock, as they seem to be these days. Went to my first game age 6. I became a season ticket holder when I was 14, I think, at Sunderland. It was pretty much the only thing me and my dad ever did together was go to watch football or watch football on TV and grumble about it. And I started working for the Sunderland fanzine. And to be honest, I didn't really sort of take football journalism seriously as a possible profession for quite a while. I started doing little bits of freelancing when I was a student, where I was essentially just to make a bit of cash on the side. And then it was only when I always sort of assumed I'd become an academic. And then it was only when I sort of fell out of love with academia that I sort of thought, maybe I'll do the journalism. And to be honest, thank goodness I did, because I'd have been quite a bad academic.
It's very self-aware of you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think I'd have been quite miserable as an academic and wouldn't have had the fun I've had being a football journalist, and almost certainly wouldn't have made as much money. So it was a very, very fortunate moment of disillusionment with academia.
So how does that lead into you deciding to write a book about tactics?
Well, I always wanted to write books. I think even, more than the academia, even that, writing books was what I wanted to do. I read books from, books have always been part of my life. And so, yeah, even when I was a kid, I was always sort of, yeah, starting writing novels, obviously getting, yeah, 100 words in and then giving up. I worked for, my first job in journalism was a website called onefootball.com, which is a global football website, which went bankrupt just after the World Cup in 2002, which wasn't really the website's fault. But you know, let's not go into those details. I sort of ended up coordinating Eastern Europe there, or our coverage of Eastern Europe, partly because I had a sort of an interest in the area. You know, been on holidays to Yugoslavia 5 times with my parents. I've been on school exchange to Russia, and partly because the more established football countries, more senior members of staff, yeah, they looked after Spain and Italy and Germany and France and Brazil and Argentina. And that was incredibly useful because it meant I got this range of contacts, you know, across Eastern Europe. So once OneFootball had gone under and I, you know, had to look for work, anytime a British club or a British country played an Eastern European team, you know, I could provide a story for papers. So that was sort of my way into newspaper journalism. And then that led to me writing my first book, Behind the Curtain, which was on football in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism. And that went pretty well. It was reviewed well. It sold, yeah, relatively okay. And we were sitting around, me and my agent, my editor, saying, yeah, what can I do next? And I'd just written a piece for a magazine looking at 10 key moments in the development tactics. And I sort of said, well, maybe there's a book in that. Maybe we could expand that. And my editor had already commissioned a book on history of football tactics from a writer from the Times called Peter Ball. And he died shortly after getting the contract. So my editor was already sold on the idea. And so, yeah, it was incredible good fortune that I then pitched that to the, you know, the bloke who already wanted to do it.
That is a fortunate time.
Well, not fortunate for Peter Ball. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the question that follows up is, because the book was written in 2008 and really gets into the history of the tactics, and I think a lot of people who read it that don't, you know, or that maybe even relatively new or just kind of a passive fan of the game are surprised to find out how much tactics have changed since the beginning of the game, how everything was very attack-minded and very little defensive-minded back in the original days. But what I'm interested in your perspective is how much is the introduction, because of a new digital age, of the heavy reliance on stats and everybody talking about XG and this and that and all of this stat stuff that really has come to dominate not just soccer, but all sports in the last 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the new frontier. And to be honest, it's very difficult to get a handle on what difference that's making, because clubs, I think quite understandably, I think there's almost an arms race going on and they don't really want to reveal exactly what they're doing. But I mean, clearly data, when handled well, gives you insights that just having scouts watching games can't give you. And I think particularly in terms of patterns of pressing, that's an incredibly powerful tool. And if you look at the very best teams, you look at Manchester City or Liverpool and look at the way they press and how specifically targeted that is on each opponent, you can't do that unless you have the data. So I think that is making a huge difference.
How much, you know, there's a lot of spending differences just in the Premier League, for as an example. And speaking about the ability of clubs to manage stats, is there still, even in 2021, a vast difference between how Man City or Liverpool is managing stats and integrating them in versus, you know, let's use Newcastle as an example, or Crystal Palace, or one of the mid-table or lower-table teams?
I mean, the truth is we don't really know, because clubs don't like to talk about it. You know, that's something that they can keep hidden away. But I suspect that, I mean, I think there was a time when the clubs who were using data cleverly were getting a competitive advantage. And I think we've seen that with, for instance, Brentford. And I think you've seen even this season that they play in a very smart way. I think their recruitment is very smart. And you know, that is stats driven. But I suspect maybe we're already at that point, but certainly in 5-10 years, the big clubs will just be able to afford the best stats people. And so in the same way you can afford the best centre forward and afford the best coach and afford the best groundsman, and it'll just enhance their advantage even further.
Do you consider the introduction of stats in this way just kind of a new version of tactical fads that have taken place, come and gone over the last several decades in the sport?
Not quite, because it is an external factor, and I think you see that in at various moments in the sport's development. So, for instance, you see it, I think you can divide football into essentially old football and new football, and I think that change happens in the early to mid 60s, and that's when we get first we get the origins of pressing. We get pressing starts in Ukraine and in the Netherlands and in England, although we don't talk about that for odd sociological reasons. But that's only possible for two reasons. One is that people start to conceive of the team as a single unit, but also it's because players are fitter than they've ever been before. And that's because boots are getting lighter, pitches are getting less bad than they had been, balls are getting lighter, but also nutrition. And it's not just that people began to understand the value of nutrition, and that drinking loads and smoking loads and eating a big steak before playing wasn't a great idea, but also food was available. And it's an extreme example, but the Liverpool team that won the league in 46-7, one of the reasons given for why they won the league is they'd taken a preseason tour of the US, where they got fed up. As in they were able to feed themselves up at a time when Britain still had rationing. I mean, rationing in Britain didn't end until 1954. Across Europe, the effects of the Second World War were felt for, a good decade after the war ended. So, stats are a bit like sports. Stats now are like sports science when what it was in the 60s. Or, I think that the Barcelona, Guardiola's Barcelona, 2008-11, they couldn't have happened without pitch technology, boot technology that made it possible to play the passing game they did, where first touch could be taken for granted.
Do you have a particular period of tactical fandom or a period of time where the game was played a particular way that's your favorite?
I think the most fascinating time, and I guess it's partly because it's tantalizingly out of reach. I think that switch I've just been talking about between the old football and the new, that what was happening in the early 60s, the coming of pressing. If I could go back in a time machine to watch any period of football, it would be then, because I just love to see that in action, that incredibly radical change. You look back at newspapers of the time, and nobody really understood what was going on at all. In particular, the coverage of England and 1966 World Cup, English journalists, English fans just didn't get what Ramsey was doing. They didn't get how radical it was. And I sort of had this realization, 5 years ago, that the change in English football from WOM to a back four is an incredibly radical change. The revolution happens in real time, and one club after another slowly kind of adopts this. And so, I went through a list of who was playing fullback for all these clubs, because fullback was a position that changed the most. And there's only three I could find who were still alive, and none of them could remember anything. They were too old to remember. And I just wish I'd had that idea 10 years ago rather than 5 years ago, and maybe I could have got people to tell me what that was actually like. But unfortunately, I fear that's gone.
So I guess my next question is there a growing change in the game that either A, excites you, or B, worries you?
I think it's sort of slightly tangential to tactics. But I think the thing that's most worrying at the minute is the gulf between the rich and the not so rich. That group of maybe a dozen super clubs who are way ahead of the rest. Yeah, so it's a problem football has that... if you win, you get the prize money, and also more people want to watch you, and more people want to watch you means you get more revenue through gate receipts, through broadcasting revenue, sponsorship, merchandising, advertising, and then you have more money, so you can buy better players, you win more, so the cycle just goes round, and it self-perpetuates. And for a long time in football, it didn't really matter, because in England up to 1961, we had a salary cap, so... having loads of money just didn't really make any difference because you couldn't spend it. Yeah, so up to 1981, 25% of gate seats were given to the away club. So having a big stadium was beneficial, but not that beneficial. But since that was abolished in 81, the rich have just got richer. And also you've had the influx of TV rights, which has changed it radically. And I think the reason England has been able to maintain, you know, a big four, a big six, or a big three, depending exactly where you draw the line, is that we do have, compared to Spain or Italy or Germany or France, a relatively equitable distribution of TV rights. But even that's changing. You know, the overseas rights used to be split absolutely equally, and that's ended. And you've seen in Germany, Bayern have won or are going to win 10 in a row. You had Juve won 9 in a row in Italy. Barcelona, Real Madrid dominating in Spain. PSG dominating in France. And that's just not healthy. And where that impinges on tactics is if you dominate your domestic league absolutely, you don't need to defend. And I think that's why in the Champions League, in the last stage of the Champions League, in recent years, we've seen so many wild swings in games because big teams have forgotten what defending is. And so they get under pressure and they just buckle. And you've seen that with Barcelona over and over and over again.
That is very true and a really good point, which leads me to this question, which is with all the kind of weird changes, the, you know, World Cups every 2 years, the Super League concept, all of these things, do you have any hope that the game has a positive future moving ahead? Or like so many other things going on in the world, it's just going to become another business oriented first kind of thing?
I really don't know. I mean, it's for somebody who, I'm slightly aware that I'm speaking from a very privileged English perspective. I grew up with a big club in an industrial city who aren't very good, but in terms of Sunderland, but they really represent the city, and so that level of connection is very profound, and it's a huge part of my identity. And I realise that, you know, if you live in the US or live in India or live in Nigeria or wherever, you want to support a Premier League team, and you don't necessarily have that connection. But I guess it is the nature of globalisation that business draws things away from the communities, and there's benefits to that, but there's also significant downsides. So I'd be lying if I said there wasn't part of me thinks a massive crash in football might not be the worst thing.
So you mentioned your fandom of Sunderland, and for me personally, the Netflix series Sunderland Till I Die is really critically important and good because it does such a good job of communicating that connection that you talk about in ways that are very unusual here in the United States. But I do wonder from your perspective, since you are a fan of the club that has been through all of that crazy on-field kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, just poorness. Do you enjoy the series at all, or is that something you repel from because it tells such a sad story of your favorite club?
No, I think it's brilliant, and I think it's done with such love for the club and love for the city. So the lads who made it were 3 years below me at school, so I'm not going to claim they're great mates, but you know, I know them slightly. But their affection for the place is absolutely genuine. I think you see that in those lingering drone shots of the cliffs, which is, you know, exactly where I grew up. So, and I think the people, the fans they got, the people at the club, I think, yeah, it was very good at expressing what the club means to a declining city. So, yeah, I thought it was a really, really great insight into the club, but also into the area. And you know, I find it very moving.
Jonathan Wilson, I appreciate you taking the time and fighting through all the technical stuff that you and I have been back and forth on for the last 30 minutes. But I will ask you one more question, which is, who is the most interesting or surprising person that you have either directly or indirectly found out read Inverting the Pyramid and had something good or bad to say about it?
Well, I mean, there's two sort of stand out. So there was Craig Levine, who was briefly, he was very successful at Hearts, and he had quite a disappointing time in charge of Scotland. And the great disaster of his reign was picking a 4-6-0 against the Czech Republic. And I think Scotland lost 1-0, but played abysmally. And he was getting hammered in a press conference, and he started defending it by reference to Inverting the Pyramid, saying, no, strikelessness is a future. I read this book, and I was like, oh, God, I mean, I hope I'm not going to get blamed for this. And then the other person was David Pleat, who you may remember was manager of Luton when they avoided relegation in 1983, and then he became manager of Tottenham. And he still does quite a bit of co-commentary on radio. And I can't remember where I was, but I was at a luggage carousel in an airport. And he came up to me and, "You're the bloke about that book, aren't you?" "Yes, I am, yeah." "Well, yeah, what you said about the five midfield and how Everton pioneered, actually, it was my top. Let me tell you about..." And he just sort of his half-hour monologue on how his Tottenham had done this kind of fractionally earlier than the Everton team I was talking about.
I did lie. I'll ask you one more question. Do you have a favorite formation of all time?
No, I don't, because I think formations are always contingent. That's the thing. There's no absolutes in tactics. Everything's dependent on what players you have, who you're playing against, what you need to get out of the game, what the conditions are. Yeah, it's not one thing is right or one thing is better than anything else. You have to get the right formation for the occasion. I think that's what makes tactics so fascinating and so difficult.
All right. Jonathan Wilson, author of Inverting the Pyramid and I think 11 other books. Is that correct?
That is right now. Yeah. Cause my novel is just coming out on Edward Streltsov, my first novel. So please do buy that this Christmas as well.
Oh, what is the name of the novel?
It's called Streltsov. It's just the surname of this Soviet player from 1958. He was a great player. And then on the eve of the 58 World Cup, he was arrested. Maybe because he committed the crime and maybe because politics intervened.
Well, consider it purchased and soon to be read by myself. Thank you so much.
Excellent.
Jonathan Wilson, I appreciate your time and thanks for fighting through this. We're all big fans here
in
Dallas.
Best of luck to whoever has to edit that.
Merry Christmas to you and yours, sir.
You too. Thank you very much.